1972, Joey Gallo killed in Little Italy during dinner at Umberto's Clam House.
An hour from now, be it tonight, or 100 years from now, I'm in jail. I mean, I was
They get there by violence, and often as not, they leave by violence.
Between $3 and $5 million in cash and valuables was taken from the Lufthansa cargo terminal out at Kennedy Airport.
I can give you guys $500,000 a year without a problem.
New York City is a war zone for mobsters and their targets.
Hello everyone and welcome to The Black Hand, an organized crime history podcast. I'm your host, Bliss Grieve, and today on episode 31, we're going to be talking about former Lucchese crime family underboss Anthony Gaspipe Caso, one of the most ruthless mobsters to ever hit the streets, with he himself eventually admitting to 36 murders. He was also the second in command to one of the most violent mafia regimes in the history of the American mafia, as Caso would order the murder of countless mobsters alongside his right-hand man, Vic Amuso. But without further ado, let's get right into today's episode. Anthony Caso was born on May 21st, 1942 in South Brooklyn, the youngest of three children of Michael and Margaret Caso, and was connected to the criminal underworld from the start. Not only was his father a low-level associate with the Genovese crime family and worked on the docks in Brooklyn, but his parents also asked a Genovese crime family capo named Salvatore Calambrano to be Anthony's godfather, who accepted. And even though Anthony's father tried his best to keep his son on the straight and narrow, by 1958, at the age of 16, Caso dropped out of school and got a job with his father as a longshoreman. Around this time, he became a crack shot, firing pistols at targets on a rooftop, which he and his friend used as a shooting range. He also made money shooting predatory hawks for pigeon keepers. But before long, he fell even deeper into the streets, and in the late 50s, Caso became a member of the infamous South Brooklyn Boys. Then in 1958, he was arrested after a rumble with local Irish hoods. After some time with the gang, Anthony caught the eye of a heavyweight associate with the Lucchese crime family named Christopher Christie Tick Frenari, who would become a major player in the family before long. Born in 1924, Frenari began running loan sharking operations in Brooklyn and northern Jersey by the age of 15, and by 1943 he had already served two prison terms for armed robbery. In 1956, after being released from another stint in prison, Frenari became an associate of the Lucchese family through his connection with the Lucchese mobster named Anthony Tony Ducks Carollo. And that's how Caso met him. Soon, Frenari gave the kid his start in loan sharking, gambling, and drug dealing. Also in 1961, he was arrested for attempted murder, but was acquitted when the alleged victim refused to testify. According to author Philip Carlo, Caso, who is known to carry a gun, engaged in an altercation with a local junkie after the junkie bothered a girl from the neighborhood. Caso became incensed and ended up shooting the junkie several times, seriously wounding him. Despite this, he was about to get a promotion in the underworld because in 1962, his mentor, Christopher Frenari, became a made man in the Lucchese family and 2 years later was made a capo. Frenari operated his crew in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn at the 19th Hole, a nondescript bar and mob social club. His crew was involved in illegal gambling, loan sharking, extortion, burglary, narcotics, and occasional murder contracts. Frenari himself also controlled New York District Council 9, which represented 6,000 workers who painted and decorated hotels, bridges, and subway stations in New York. He managed the council through the union secretary and treasurer James Bishop, as well as his associate Frank Arnold. Bishop and Arnold would pick up cash from the contractors, who charged a 10-15% tax on all major commercial painting jobs and passed the payments to Frenari. And it took no time at all for Caso to become part of this extremely powerful crew as he began to hang around the 19th hole, which marked an increase in his activity in the streets. While he would be arrested 5 times between 1965 and 1977 on state and federal charges ranging from assault with a gun to heroin trafficking, all cases ended in dismissals after witnesses refused to testify against him. But despite Caso's legal troubles, the Lucchese family were about to have some problems of their own because on July 13, 1967, the family's boss, Tommy Lucchese, died of a brain tumor. His obvious first choice for a successor had been his protege, Anthony Tony Ducks Carollo, but Carollo was in prison when Lucchese died, so the commission chose a Lucchese mobster named Carmen Tremonti to stand in as temporary acting boss until Carollo was released from prison. Some historians have speculated that Carollo became boss immediately upon his 1970 release from prison and that Tremonti was simply an acting or front boss for the next 3 years. But on May 7, 1973, Tremonti was sentenced to 15 years in federal prison, at which point Carollo became the undisputed boss of the Lucchese family. It was really during this era under Carollo that Caso would thrive and work his way up in the family. Because it was in the early 1970s that Caso made his bones by murdering a drug dealer suspected of being a snitch. Also in the early 70s, Caso would meet a fellow rising Lucchese associate named Vittorio Vic Amuso, who would eventually become his right-hand man. Born on November 4th, 1934, Musso grew up in Canarsie, Brooklyn, and by the late 1940s, he was introduced to the life when he met Anthony Corallo, a then-prominent capo in the Gagliano crime family. When he got older, Musso even acted as bodyguard and driver to Carmen Tremonti. He later became an enforcer for Profaci family mobster Joey Gallo in Brooklyn, and during the First Colombo Family War, it's rumored that Musso killed several members of the Profaci faction. But he was sent to prison sometime in the early 60s along with Joey Gallo and a dozen others on extortion charges. After Joey Gallo's release from prison in early 1971, he continued his war against the family, but when he was caught in Little Italy while he was celebrating his 43rd birthday, many Colombo family mobsters, especially those from the old Gallo crew, defected to other families. Musso went to the Lucchese family sometime during that year as an associate with the 19th Hole crew led by Christopher Fenari, eventually becoming one of Fenari's top proteges along with Anthony Casso. On December 21, 1972, Musso was arrested by police outside the house on Morgan Avenue, a front for the Bronx Connection kickback scheme which involved selling prison paroles for as high as $20,000 apiece to prison inmates. However, it was in the late 1970s that Musso and Casso would get the promotion they had been looking for when they were made in the Lucchese crime family. After being made, Casso was assigned to the crew of a Lucchese capo named Vincent Fosseri, which operated from 116th Street in Manhattan and from 14th Avenue in Brooklyn. Despite this, Casso remained heavily partnered with Vic and Musso, and they became a two-man crime spree during the 1970s and 80s, involved in everything from fraud and extortion to gambling and drug trafficking. But the two didn't get to enjoy their newfound power for long, as on May 30th, 1977, Musso was arrested with Casso for their involvement in a heroin trafficking ring involving the Sicilian Mafia and a pipeline from Thailand to the United States. At the time of their arrest, the two were found to be in possession of 3 pounds of heroin. Reportedly, the heroin operation was headed by Musso, his cooperator Casso, and two associates from the Lucchese family whom were all sent to prison. However, when they got out, the two stepped up their game and used members of Fenari's 19th Hole crew to form a burglary ring comprised of safecrackers, expert locksmith, and experts in security alarm systems called the Bypass Gang, which broke into banks and jewelry stores in Manhattan and Long Island, and according to estimates, the gang made off with over $100 million worth of stolen merchandise. But it wouldn't be long before Casso was offered another step up in the streets because when his capo, Christopher Fenari, was promoted to consigliere of the Lucchese family following the death of Vincent Fosseri, he was left trying to find someone to replace him as the leader of the old 19th Hole crew. Fenari offered the position to Casso, but he declined, suggesting that Musso be promoted instead, at which point Musso became the new capo and controlled the 19th Hole crew and retained Casso as his right-hand man. Casso also continued working directly for Fenari as well as on his behalf. And despite this step up for the rising mobsters, the New York Mafia was about to be plunged into a period of dysfunction and overall defeat, because during the early 1980s, Anthony Tony Duck Scarallo, boss of the Lucchese crime family, unwittingly provided the government with evidence that would all but end his career in the streets. Over the years, Corallo and Lucchese capo named Salvatore Avellino established a stranglehold on the waste hauling business on Long Island. So to gather evidence against Avellino, members of the New York State Organized Crime Task Force used an undercover informant named Robert Kubechka, who owned a Suffolk County garbage hauling business. Since the 1970s, Kubechka had refused to participate with the mob control of the waste hauling business and had suffered extensive harassment as a result, so in 1982, Kubechka agreed to wear a surveillance device during meetings with the mobsters. And although Kubechka was unable to get close to Avellino himself, the information that he gathered eventually persuaded a judge to allow a wiretap on Avellino's home phone in Issaquogu, New York. The home phone tap was also disappointing to the agents, however it did reveal that Avellino was driving Anthony Corallo around all day in Avellino's car, and in 1983, members of the New York State Organized Crime Task Force installed an electronic listening device inside the dashboard of Avellino's Jaguar while he and his wife were out at dinner. Agents then listened to many conversations between Corallo, Avellino, and other mobsters as they drove around the city. From these recorded conversations, the task force learned about the New York Mafia's internal structure, history, and relations with other crime families. These conversations were shared with federal prosecutors and provided them with invaluable evidence against Corallo and other family bosses involved in the Mafia Commission case. And as a result, on February 25, 1985, Corallo and other mob leaders were indicted in the Commission case. However, Corallo was in the hospital and wasn't arrested until after his release a few days later. Among the defendants were also Lucchese family underboss Salvatore, Tom Mix Santoro, and consigliere Christopher Fenari. But the Commission case wasn't the only problem weighing on the five families around this time, as in December of 1985, Frank DiCicco, John Gotti, and several other heavyweights in the Gambino crime family plotted to kill the family's boss, Paul Castellano, eventually succeeding. Around that time before the hit, Casso was approached by Gambino capo Frank DiCicco regarding the planned coup, as he and Gotti were looking for support among the other four families affected by the Mafia Commission trial. According to Gambino capo Sammy Gravano, DiCicco returned from the meeting saying that Casso had offered the conspirators his unconditional support, but would later denounce Gotti's actions as, quote, the beginning of the end of our thing. And ironically enough, it would be Casso who was sent out to avenge the death of Castellano, because following the hit, hit, Lucchese boss Anthony Corallo and Genovese boss Vincent Gigante were enraged and decided to kill Gotti, DeChicco, and every other conspirator in Castellano's murder. At which point Cosimo and Vicomusso were chosen to handle the assassinations and were instructed to try and shift his suspicion to Sicilian mobsters or Zips, which Castellano was known to work closely with. However, the pair would only ever make one attempt on the lives of Gotti and DeChicco, because with Gambino Capo, Danny Marino, as their inside man, Casso and Amuso learned of a meeting Gotti had set at the Veterans and Friends Social Club in Brooklyn run by Gambino Capo, James Faglia. So on April 13, 1986, Casso had a Genovese associate named Herbert Pate rig the Buick Electra belonging to Gotti and Frank DeChicco with explosives, but Gotti canceled his attendance last minute and as a result only DeChicco was killed. However, this wasn't the only problem that Casso would have to deal with around this time, as he was about to be called upon to protect his interests in the gas tax scheme. Casso had a close alliance with a Russian crime boss named Merit Balagula, who owned countless gas stations throughout Brighton Beach, Brooklyn. Italian and Russian organized crime made large amounts of money by working scams to avoid paying taxes on gasoline, but it was the Russians who really owned the gas stations and controlled the supply and distribution of gasoline, so the Italians simply provided protection for a cut. The main guy working with the Lucchese family was Balagula, who was one of the early leaders of Russian organized crime in Brooklyn and made millions off the gas tax business. So after a Colombo capo named Michael Francis began shaking down his crew for a percentage of their profits, Balagula approached Lucchese family consigliere Christopher Frenari and asked for a sit-down at the 19th Hole Cruise Social Club in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn. And it was at this meeting where Frenari and Casso agreed to protect Balagula's business interests as a Lucchese associate in exchange for a cut of the profits. The street tax from Balagula's operation wasn't only strategically shared, but also became the Five family's biggest money-making racket after drug trafficking. Shortly afterward, Balagula's rival, a fellow Russian immigrant named Vladimir Reznikov, who had recently arrived in Brighton Beach, drove up to Balagula's office building in the Midwood section of Brooklyn. While sitting in his car, Reznikov opened fire on the building with an AK-47, resulting in the death of one of Balagula's close associates and the wounding of several secretaries. Then on June 12, 1986, Reznikov entered the Rasputin nightclub in Brighton Beach and put a 9mm Beretta against Balagula's head, demanding $600,000 in exchange for not pulling the trigger. He also demanded a percentage of everything Balagula was involved in, and after he promised to get their money, Reznikov threatened him and his family. Shortly after Reznikov left, Balagula suffered a massive heart attack and insisted on being treated at his home in Brighton Beach, where he felt it would be harder for Reznikov to kill him. When Casso arrived, he listened to Balagula's story and was enraged. Casso later told Philip Carlo that in his mind, Reznikov had just spat in the face of Cosa Nostra. So Casso told Balagula to call Reznikov and tell him that he had his money and should meet him at the club the following day. Casso also requested a photo of Reznikov and a description of his car. Following the meeting, Casso and Vicomusso received permission from Lucchese consigliere Christopher Frenari to have Reznikov killed. The following day, Reznikov returned to the nightclub expecting to pick up his money, but upon realizing Balagula wasn't there, he launched into a barrage of profanity and stormed back to the parking lot. There, a veteran with the Roy DeMeo crew named Joseph Testa walked up behind Reznikov and shot him dead. Testa then jumped into a car driven by another DeMeo crew member named Anthony Center and left Brighton Beach. Casso would later say, quote, "After that, Merritt didn't have any other problems with Russians." However, by late 1986, Anthony Casso would become the hunted one as his attempt on the lives of Frank DeChicco and John Gotti came back to bite him when a Gambino family capo and right-hand man to John Gotti named Angelo Ruggiero ordered the murder of Casso. Three Gambino associates named Jimmy Heidel, Nick Guido, and Eddie Lino were all placed on the hit. On September 12, 1986, in Brooklyn, while Casso was sitting in his car outside of a restaurant, a car containing the hit team of Heidel, Guido, and Lino pulled up beside Casso's car and opened fire. Casso was hit but managed to get out of the car and enter a nearby restaurant and lock himself in the restaurant's freezer, where he hid until the police showed up. Soon after, the NYPD started their investigation and quickly identified a Gambino family associate named Jimmy Heidel as one of their assassins. But the police weren't the only ones looking for the shooters, as Casso had committed himself to killing everybody involved in his shooting, which was made all the easier by his crystal ball. Two NYPD detectives named Stephen Caracappa and Louis Eppolito, who had gone rogue and started working for the mob, ending up on Casso's payroll. So because of the attempted assassination on Casso's life, he placed the crooked cops on retainer for $4,000 a month. The two cops were put on the payroll to give Casso highly classified information that only law enforcement had access to, and to deliver Heidel directly to Casso. Just a little over a month after the shooting on October 18th, 1986, Eppolito and Caracappa kidnapped Heidel, stuck him in the trunk of a car, and delivered him to a house in Brooklyn where Casso was waiting. Once there, Casso strapped Heidel to a chair in the basement of the home and attempted to extract information by using Heidel as target practice, pumping bullet after bullet into his limbs. He finally succumbed to the torture and gave Casso the names of Gambino family family associates Nicky Guido and Eddie Lino. By this point, Casso had shot Heidel a total of 14 times and ended his life once and for all with a bullet to the head. Heidel's body has never been found. However, not long after the murder of Heidel, things were about to take a huge turn for Casso, one that would catapult Casso and Vic Amuso to the major leagues of the mob. Because as the Mafia Commission trial wore on in 1986, boss of the Lucchese family, Anthony Corallo, realized that the entire Lucchese hierarchy was about to be decimated. Not only was it all but certain that he, his underboss Salvatore Santoro, and his consigliere Christopher Fornari would be convicted, but they also faced sentences that at their ages would all but assure that they would die in prison. So in the fall of 1986, Corallo began scrambling to find a replacement, eventually settled on a capo in the Harlem Bronx faction named Anthony Luongo, who was a longtime protege of Corallo's underboss, Salvatore Santoro. However, this natural succession wouldn't last long because, according to an informant named Little Al Diarco, the murder of Luongo was organized by Vic Amuso and Anthony Casso, who suspected the underboss Salvatore Santoro was plotting with his protégés Luongo and Anthony DeLapi. So in December 1986, Luongo was lured to the 19th Old Bar in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn to meet with Vic Amuso, who persuaded Luongo to meet him in a nearby house. In the Brooklyn home, Luongo met with Vic Amuso, Anthony Casso, Bobby Amuso, and Don Carbucci until Bobby Amuso excused himself and returned, killing Luongo by shooting him 3 times in the head. He was later buried somewhere in Canarsie, Brooklyn. So in light of this news, Corallo obviously had to find another replacement and held a meeting at Christopher Fornari's home, where Corallo told Fornari that he wanted the capo of Fornari's old crew, Vic Amuso, or Fornari's right-hand man, Anthony Casso, as his successor. At which point Fornari, Amuso, and Casso met in a separate room where Casso passed up the opportunity to become the boss in favor of Vic Amuso, reminiscent of 1980 when Casso declined the offer to become the capo of Fornari's crew when he became consigliere, and ultimately it was decided that Amuso would take the mantle. And though Corallo reportedly preferred Casso, he agreed to make Amuso acting boss later that year, and it was understood that he would formally become boss when Corallo, Santoro, and Fornari were expected to be convicted and sent to prison. Which happened on November 19, 1986, when Corallo and the other defendants were convicted of all racketeering charges, with Corallo eventually being sentenced to 100 years in prison. Once official boss of the Lucchese family, Amuso promoted a mobster named Mariano Macaluso to underboss and made Casso his consigliere. But this position really just made Casso feel even more untouchable than ever, and as a result, anyone even suspected of being an informant, Casso either personally killed or ordered a hit on. To stay informed, Casso kept NYPD officers Stephen Caracappa and Louis Eppolito on his payroll in exchange for them tipping off Casso about snitches or coming informants, eventually resulting in the murder of 8 people for Casso. Meanwhile, the FBI began surveilling Casso as he spent $30,000 on suits and ran up $1,000 restaurant bills. Despite this promotion, however, Casso hadn't forgot about the attempt on his life and continued to try and take all the shooters off the street, and next up on his list was Nicholas Guido. So he asked Eppolito and Caracappa for a 411 on the guy, but when they entered his name in the database, they pulled the address of a different man, a 26-year-old also named Nicholas Guido with no ties to organized crime. And on December 25th, 1986, he was shot outside his mother's home on 17th Street in Park Slope, Brooklyn. The alleged shooter was a former DeMeo crew member named Joey Testa. But Casso wouldn't be dormant for long, and in late 1987, he would order the murders of 2 men. The first murder occurred on September 3rd, 1987, when the Lucchese family soldier named Carmen Variola was shot to death outside of a social club in Bath Beach, Brooklyn, for trying to avenge his brother's murder. In the hail of bullets, a Bonanno family associate named Frank Santoro was also killed. The hit team consisted of mobsters Frank Smith Jr. and Sr., as well as Michael Cilone. The second was that of a 47-year-old Lucchese associate and member of the Bypass Gang named John Heidel, who was suspected of being an informant and was shot to death in October 1987 while fixing a flat tire on his car. So it probably comes as no surprise that during the late 1980s, the Lucchese family underwent a period of great turmoil because Vic Amuso and Anthony Casso, the first members of the family's Brooklyn wing to head the family, instituted one of the most violent reigns in American mafia history. Both men were heavily involved in labor racketeering and drug trafficking, and both had committed numerous murders. The two were also strong rivals of Gambino boss John Gotti and strong allies of Genovese boss Vincent Gigante. During the late 1980s, Amuso began demanding 50% of the profits generated by the family's Jersey crew, but leaders within the Jersey faction named Anthony Assaturo and Michael Tassetta refused Amuso's demand. In retaliation, Amuso and Casso ordered a capo named Little Al Diarco and the Vario crew to murder the entire Jersey crew, which is now known as the infamous Whack Jersey Order. He summoned them all to a meeting in Brooklyn, but fearful for their lot. He summoned them all to a meeting in Brooklyn, but fearful for their lives, the entire Jersey crew skipped the meeting and went into hiding. The leaders of the faction were only spared when Tassetta and Assaturo were later put on trial in 1990. 1990 would also see Casso get another promotion. Amuso replaced his underboss named Mario Macaluso with Anthony Casso and made a capo named Stephen Crea, the family's new consigliere. By the time Casso was made underboss, he had ordered the murders of suspected informants across Harlem, the Bronx, and New Jersey, totaling at least 17 people by 1991. However, just as Casso was settling into his new position, both he and Amuso were implicated in the infamous Windows case, but before the indictments dropped, the pair was warned by corrupt NYPD officers Louis Eppolito and Stephen Caracappa and went into hiding. So for the next few years, Amuso and Casso ruled the family from afar, using little Adiarco as their acting boss. While on the run, Casso continued trying to get revenge for his shooting nearly 4 years prior, and in 1990, he ordered the murder of a Gambino family capo named Eddie Lino, who was part of the hit team sent after Casso. And on November 6, 1990, Lino was found murdered while sitting in his car on a road leading onto the Belt Parkway in Brooklyn, effectively ending Casso's crusade against the hit team that tried to kill him. In 2006, the mob cops Louis Eppolito and Stephen Caracappa were found guilty of the murder and sentenced to life in prison. Also during that time, Casso and Amuso were on the run. The two continued to order the execution of anyone they deemed troublesome, typically because they were considered rivals or potential informants, resulting in Casso ordering the murders of 12 mobsters, convincing many in the Lucchese family that Amuso and Casso were no longer acting or thinking rationally. What followed was a series of botched hits on family members suspected of being informants, and ironically, these hits would cause several family members to actually turn informant. Amuso ordered the slaying of Lucchese capo named Peter Chiodo, who along with Casso was in charge of the family's interest in the Windows racket. Chiodo had recently been arrested on RICO charges, and the two assumed he had turned informant. So they assigned the hit to Little Adiarco, and on May 8, 1991, two Lucchese shooters ambushed Chiodo while he was working on a car at a gas station in Staten Island. He was hit with 12 bullets in the arms, legs, and torso, but survived the attack and went on to give damning testimony against the family. However, Amuso and Casso were about to show yet again just how crazy they were becoming when they crafted a list of 49 people they wanted dead, half of whom were made men of the Lucchese family. He also ordered Little Adiarco to bring in a bomb expert from the Philadelphia family as part of a plan to blow up Gambino boss John Gotti Jr. Casso even conspired with reputed consigliere Frank Lazzarino and Brooklyn faction leaders George Zappola, George Conti, Frank Pagani, and Frank Gioia into murdering a capo named Stephen Crea. Meanwhile, Little Adiarco knew that Casso and Amuso blamed him for having failed to murder Peter Chiodo and grew certain that they were planning to kill him. Further cementing this theory in his head, in July 1991, during a meeting in Staten Island, Amuso and Casso replaced Adiarco as acting boss with a four-man ruling panel of capos including Adiarco, Anthony Barada, Frank Lazzarino, and Salvatore Avellino. Then on July 29, 1991, due to a tip-off from an unidentified Lucchese insider, Vic Amuso was arrested, at which point Casso reluctantly became the Lucchese family's de facto boss. It has been speculated that Casso himself was the source of the leak, as only a few people were privy to Amuso's location. This theory is contradicted, however, by Philip Carlo, who states that Casso was not only determined to find out who betrayed Amuso and killed them, but Casso also immediately sent the $250,000 that was due to Amuso to his wife in a shoebox. Casso, according to Carlo, and evident by his past actions, had no desire to be boss of the Lucchese family and attempted to arrange Amuso's escape from federal custody after his arrest. To the disappointment of Casso and the Lucchese capos, Amuso refused to leave prison out of fear for his life, and as a result, the Lucchese capos asked Casso to take over as acting boss, and he reluctantly accepted. Then, by September of 1991, Little Adiarco was certain that Casso and Amuso had marked him and his family for death, so that afternoon, Adiarco phoned FBI agent Robert Marston. Adiarco explained that his life was in danger and that the Lucchese family had started killing the entire families of suspected informants, which had never previously been allowed. After some hesitation, Adiarco finally told Agent Marston that he and his family were in hiding at his mother's house in Long Island, and later that night, Adiarco and his family entered witness protection. The defections of both Little Adiarco and Peter Chiodo opened the door for new murder indictments against Casso and Amuso, and as a result, Amuso was convicted of 54 counts of racketeering, including 9 murders on June 15, 1991, eventually being sentenced to life in prison a year later, but he remained boss of the Lucchese family using acting bosses to handle the day-to-day operations. Then, in a further violation of the Mafia's code, Peter Chiodo's extended family in Brooklyn soon suffered retaliation from Amuso and Casso. And on March 10, 1991, a Vario crew enforcer named Michael Spinelli shot Chiodo's sister, Patricia Capozzolo, while she was driving in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn. She sustained bullet wounds in her arm, back, and neck, but survived. Meanwhile, investigators from the Brooklyn District Attorney's Office were using technology to trace the location of cell phones, and the Lucchese family's consigliere, Frank Lazzarino, they found was regularly calling a cell phone near Bud Lake, New Jersey. So the DA's office informed FBI agent Richard Rudolph, who arranged for a federal warrant allowing Lazzarino's phone to be tapped, and as agents listened in, they recognized Casso's voice. And as a result, on January 19, 1993, Casso was arrested while coming out of the shower at the house he shared with his mistress in Mount Olive, New York. As FBI agents searched the house, they found a rifle, $340,000 in cash, a stack of FBI reports that had been provided to Amuso's defense attorney, and meticulous paperwork about the inner workings of the Lucchese family. The paperwork included monthly calculations of how much money Casso and Amuso had received from each of their criminal operations. Casso had also written down a detailed list of the Christmas tribute money that he and Amuso received from each Lucchese crew. There was even a neatly typed list of proposed made men, which was disguised as a list of wedding guests. Casso was held at New York's Metropolitan Correctional Center pending trial, facing charges that assured he would die in prison, but he continued ordering hits on the outside and even began making escape plans. One plan almost succeeded when a bribed guard cleared him through security. He nearly walked out of the jail, but was spotted by another guard and stopped at the last minute. Afterwards, Casso began making plans for Lucchese members to find out what prison buses would be transporting him and arrange an ambush, as well as assassinating the presiding judge to buy himself more time. Then on February 2nd, 1993, the body of Frank Signorino, Peter Chiodo's uncle, was found frozen solid in the trunk of a car in East New York. He had been killed by multiple gunshot wounds to the head, which was wrapped in a black plastic bag. Not long after, Casso's power came undone when Ficamuso not only stripped Casso of his title of underboss, but also declared that all Lucchese mobsters should consider him a pariah, in effect banishing him from the family. So with no support from the family and facing the prospect of a trial in which Little Al DiArco, Anthony Aslatoro, and Peter Chiodo were due to be star witnesses against him, as well as spending the rest of his life in prison, Casso reached out to FBI agent Richard Rudolph and offered to turn informant, at which point he was immediately moved to the federal prison at La Tuna near El Paso, Texas, and housed in the famous Valachi suite as he debriefed. One of Casso's first big revelations came when he disclosed that two decorated NYPD detectives named Stephen Caracappa and Louis Eppolito had been on his payroll and committed 8 murders under his orders. Casso further explained that the two detectives who had also served on the Federal Organized Crime Task Force had also leaked the names of both police and FBI informants, which had resulted in many other murders. He also named scores of mobsters that he had conspired with, including Genovese family boss Vincent Gigante, confessed to having hitmen sent to federal prosecutor Charles Rose's home with the intention of having him murdered, and admitted to having plotted the assassination of a federal judge in order to delay his own trial. Casso initially confessed to 12 murders, but when he was pressed for details, he admitted to a further 24. At the same time, he was found to have lied about how much money he possessed. He also denied all involvement in the murder of Peter Chiodo's uncle or in the arson at the home of Chiodo's elderly grandmother, so FBI agents made Casso take a lie detector, which he failed. Federal prosecutor Gregory O'Connell later told journalist Jerry Capisci that the decision not to use Casso as a witness was made in the Valachi suite while Casso gleefully laughed as he described how he buried alive a young drug smuggling associate in the Florida Everglades. Afterwards, both O'Connell and another federal prosecutor named Charles Rose flew back to New York City, convinced that Casso's knowledge of the mafia's secrets didn't matter, with O'Connell later saying, quote, "It gets to a point where somebody is just too able to put on the stand." Despite this, Casso finalized a plea agreement hearing on March 1, 1994, where he pleaded guilty to 70 crimes, including racketeering, extortion, and 15 murders. The two lead prosecutors on the case, Charles Rose and Gregory O'Connell, later said that they had feared Casso would be acquitted at trial since they didn't have taped conversations as evidence, and in the meantime, Casso was placed in the witness protection program. But in 1998, Casso was removed from witness protection after prosecutors alleged numerous infractions, including bribing guards, assaulting other inmates, and making false statements about Sammy Gravano and Little Al DiArco. And as a result, Casso was subsequently sentenced to 455 years in prison without the possibility of parole, the maximum sentence permitted under sentencing guidelines, and began serving his sentence at the Supermax prison known as ADX Florence in Colorado. According to the Federal Bureau of Prisons, Casso was transferred to the Federal Medical Center at the Federal Complex in Butner, North Carolina, for the treatment of prostate cancer in March 2009. But in his later years, Casso would develop complications related to prostate cancer, coronary artery disease, kidney disease, hypertension, bladder disease, and lung issues from years of smoking. Then on November 5th, 2020, he tested positive for COVID-19 and was transported to a local hospital due to respiratory distress and put on a ventilator. December 15th, 2020, Casso died from complications related to COVID-19 at the age of 78 years old. But that's really all I have for you guys today. I hope everybody thoroughly enjoyed today's episode and tunes back in next week for episode 32. If you enjoyed today's show and like to support the podcast, it'd be great if you could follow, like, and share the podcast, as well as the show's Instagram and Twitter pages at The Black Hand Pod. But with that said, I hope everybody has a great rest of their day. This is your host, Bliss Grieve, signing out.